listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Welcome to Aloud at Central Library. I'm Louise Steinman, the curator of the Aloud series, and I'm delighted to welcome you to, which is our 17th annual Newer Poets Reading. We're very excited about it. And also the last program for the Aloud series of this season. We love to end it with this program. And I think it's going to be a great night hearing some wonderful poems, some from people we have heard, some from people we haven't heard from before. It's going to be a great mix. Our format tonight, we have three guest curators. I'm going to introduce each of them, and they are in turn going to introduce the two poets each whom they have selected. I think it's safe to say that our three guest poet curators tonight are quintessential voices of the Southern California poetry scene and far beyond that. All three of them either currently teach or have taught, and they've all been influential and generous in their mentoring of their poetry students and in their contributions to creating a cultural community here in Los Angeles. You can read more about each of them on the Library Foundation of Los Angeles blog. Our wonderful poet Bridget Bates, who works for the Library Foundation, did an interview with Suzanne and Eloise and Gail and posted it up on the Library Foundation blog, and it's a really fun way to get to know more about their background. As I said, each of the three curators will introduce their two poets. We're going to start with Suzanne Lummis, who's the president and founding director of the Los Angeles Poetry Festival, with whom Aloud has now collaborated for 17 years on this series. Suzanne's work is widely published. She was the principal editor of Grand Passion, The Poetry of Los Angeles and Beyond, and her most recent collection is In Danger from Heyday Books. She's a longtime instructor in creative writing at UCLA Extension Creative Writing Program, where she's been the recipient of their Outstanding Instructor Award in Creative Writing. After Suzanne's two poets read, we will hear from Eloise Klein-Healy, who is the author of 6 books of poetry and 3 spoken word recordings, unless there's something that's come since then. Her latest collection is The Islands Project, Poems for Sappho. In early 2013, Red Hen Press will publish A Wild Surmise, New and Selected Poems. Eloise is the founding editor of Arctoy Books, which is an imprint of Red Hen Press, and she is Distinguished Professor of Creative Writing Emerita, Antioch University, LA, where she was the founding chair of their MFA in creative writing. I used to say emerita, but it took me a while to figure that out. Gail Ronsky teaches poetry writing, and women's literature at Loyola Marymount, and her work appears in many journals. She's also a member of the Glass Table Collective. Among her books are So Quick, Bright Things, which is What Books Press, with Spanish translations by Alicia Partnoy, Blue Shadow, Beyond Everything Dazzling, Poems from India, and co-author with Molly Bendel of Bling and Fringe, the LA Poems. Her other books also include Poems for Infidels, Dying for Beauty, and her translation of Alicia Partnoy's poems, Volando Bajito, was published in 2005. These are three fantastic women, fantastic poets. Please welcome our first guest curator, Suzanne Lummis. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Oh, I'm getting whoops. Thank you. What an enthusiastic, lively audience. Now, in our 17th year, there are several reasons that the newer poets love to be chosen for this program. First and foremost, they love to come to the Central Library and be in this beautiful auditorium as part of the Aloud series funded by the Library Foundation. Secondly, they love to have you as an audience. That's the second most important reason. Thirdly, they like to meet each other and get to know each other and form lifelong friendships. And finally, they're so pleased. Of course, poets aren't materialistic, so it's way down on the list, but they're pleased to be so well paid. And they're well paid because of the Library Foundation and Poets and Writers, Inc. over there. Jamie Fitzgerald, could you stand up? She's all embarrassed now. All right, she just waved. So they are, even though they're, you know, they don't do it for the money, of course, but they're always pleasantly surprised and pleased. Now, Roland Vason, where are you? There is Roland Vason. All right. Roland Vason was a no-brainer for this. We like to pick poets who have really worked at the craft and the art with great love for a long time. And in addition to that, Roland has been such a supporter of poetry in Los Angeles. He is known all across the city. He goes to readings everywhere. I think he's one of the very loved poets of this city. And as well as being a very conscientious writer with humor and pathos, he's a hell of a presenter of his work, just a hell of a presenter of his work. And so he's so deserving, Roland, for all the work you've done on your poetry and everything you've given to Los Angeles poets and poetry. Come on up.
Hello. I wanted to play for this with this button for years. Thank you. Thank you, curators of Aloud's Newer Poet Series and the Los Angeles Public Library Foundation for this opportunity. And thank you, Suzanne, and the Los Angeles Poetry Festival for your motivating patience, the learned craft of poetry, and this precious honor tonight. These first two short poems bracket an American era which has not quite closed. Advanced calculus. Professor is intent on making a point about his equation from a grid of topographical mapping coordinates. Cylinder of chalk clacks on the blackboard, reverberates. Emphasis hand flies into the dusty space in front of the board. The loudspeaker in university's bell tower crackles. A monotone voice announces cancellation of the day's classes. In mid-windup, prof grimaces at the loud interruption, shakes a fist. A student blurts that President Kennedy was shot in Dallas. Professor's shoulders droop. Face goes slack. Chalk falls from his hand. Mathematics gives way to induction. Our careers drift out the window. Vietnam veteran. Discharged, homeless, nobody looks through my weathered wrinkles. They spit on my shadow from behind. None uses my name or touches me in my cardboard box. Even your police wear rubber gloves. I was not resisting arrest. I just did not comprehend. You beat me until dead. I'll be right back. Death is overrated, in fact, does not exist. I was not born. I have always been alive. When my body becomes worn out, my essence will return to Earth and appear again somewhere in the universe. I do not dread death, that my body fearfully seeks to protect itself, a mere consequence of my animal manifestation. No angst either over loss of my beloveds. I will never abandon them. I will always be a breeze in their mind wind and visit each yard site in the candle's flicker in the Sabbath table stories of my stunts. Tread softly on our blue-green planet. It's me upon whom you will be walking. This story is in the voice of the woman who told it to me. Christmas Eve. Still, still snow drifts up. Roses hunker against stone walls, city streets on fire. Shadow people dance behind flames. Barrel pressed below my jaw, muzzle rigid on my artery, my face pressed to cement for rear entry, organ tissue tears. The gentleman asks my age. I give a younger number so he'll think me more worthy of raping. As quickly as the takedown blossoms, his storm surge subsides to faint odors. Weapon withdrawn without prejudice, he shares, it's not personal. I thank him. The cop asks me what I was wearing. Visit from sister to cleanse wounds, she asks how I am feeling. I make sounds like loose change in the grammar of desperation. I want him to call. I want him to write. I want him to text. Silent, holy night turns at the edge of town. Confession. I shot a wren on an apple tree branch with my BB rifle. My Christmas gift, the one I scoured the house for until I saw the gun box in the broom closet. Santa did get my letter. The wren swung off his perch into an orchard furrow. On his back, carcass warm, hazed eyes, I shot another. Then dozens fell on the frosted mantle of winter. Stray cats pawed and picked at the tiny bodies. It's always spring to cats when death is loose on cultivated fields. Summer, a sparrow was flopping a loose wing on the lawn. I wanted to mend it. Keep her as a pet. I built a little pen, held to my chest, her gyrations amped. My gut clenched at my failure to mellow her agonal wildness, a tone for my winter serial murders. I mercied two fingers over the head, flicked my wrist wrapped in rags, hid its broken body under other trash in our dumpster. No good poetry reading is complete without at least one broken heart poem. This is mine. Combustion. You ignited my well fire. Endless feed to burn. I torched the night sky. I popped off my top hat. We shag danced in the devil's slippers. Conflagration reigned. Sirens beckoned toward molten coals. We burned bedposts, asphalt off roads, all the bridges to eternity. Belladonna recaptured your body. With as little as a changed mind, you top-killed my wellhead. Blaze out, feed plugged like a self-cleaning oven. All that's left was a little pile of gray ash from our drippy messes. A bottomless pit for more arson. I'm blind to consequence. My hands crawl low arroyos, strike iron rocks for latent sparks. And you got to have a little silliness. This triggered by Brendan Constantine's workshop of the same name, Industrial Poetry. Plenum wrench under the shim nozzle, I rammed the manual detent with alacrity, only to discover that the gasket shank had drifted away before false dawn. Bushing flanged, I tried to ratchet knurl a bigger Yankee screwdriver, and for my effort was rewarded with oiled scupper seeds. Flummoxed out of my gourd, I loosed a mighty pelican hook from bosun's locker and lathed the next hawse pipe to within an inch of its choker cable, not forgetting to vice grip the torque nuts until ball peen squirmed. Don't ever say that I need a metric hammer for better results, or that an oscillating saw trumps a reverse star bit, because I know when my Johnson rod is arcing. Thank you. Finally, one mustn't forget a reference to mother in such an august event as this, as read at Betty Vassen's Unitarian Memorial Service, inside mother's refrigerator. Vessels checked in but didn't check out. Pickled herring and sour cream with no label to identify its century of origin. Green cocktail olives from the 1930s, I guessed, that were no doubt black at some distant past. Milk that soured in one day out of self-protection. Among and within the international choir of half or less filled containers lived several dozen species of bacteria, molds, fungi, and as yet unnamed spores grown into a rainbow of leafy profusion. No space available for mayonnaise, Weber's bread, or strawberry crush to tempt the attention of a teenager. An international harvester brand freezer, fridge, crisper combination. This particular unit had no knowledge of the words fresh or crisp. The fridge's interior could only be considered nurturing if botulism could be considered nutritional. As though Depression-era food hoarding remained in 1963, there being no other apparent explanation for the gathering storm of bottles, jars, cans, sacks, Tupperware, and Melmac, all partially full, if only, with a stain of long-forsaken, formerly edible objects dehydrated and left for whoever was in the greatest need. A black hole of used food meant to feed the starving, domestic and foreign, who tramped through her dining room for their weekly Sunday suppers, but were never offered the delicacies from mother's mausoleum of deceased sustenance. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise Steinman, for being the visionary of the Allowed series. Oh, let's give her a hand. Yes. I hope that those of you who still have some money left, because you didn't lose all of it in the various financial crises and pitfalls that we've been going through, I hope that some of you who have money left will become members of the Library Foundation, because I'm a member and I can testify that they treat you really, really well. One of the things that happens for audiences who come here and that you hear the Newer Poets series is you get introduced to such a range of voices that you can walk out of here saying that you really know what's going on in contemporary poetry. And my next poet, Angela, where are you? Are you down there? There's Angela. Angela just returned from from the Philippines. And many of her poems deal with the culture and the life of the Philippines, the politics. When she first came to me as a student, she was very gifted right from the start, but her poetry sort of sprawled out and was sort of thin and talking. Boy, it's not like that anymore. It is so dense, so rich, so sensuous. I'm going to go so far as to say that it's sexy. And its sensuality, its just tactile quality, and the lushness of the imagery, and it is often political. It is never haranguing. It is always subtle, and I think it will leave you in a very sensuous mood. All right, Angela.
God represent all the short people. I just wanted to, give a big, juicy thanks to the Library Foundation of LA. The Allowed series, it's like such a kick-ass event. So it's really good to be a part of it. I'm really honored to be reading with such a sharp, hip lineup of poets tonight. and all the other poets that came before. So it's really a pleasure to be up here. Deep thanks to Suzanne Lummis for asking me to be part of this, for supporting my work, for whipping me into shape when I needed it most. And it's also a pleasure to be amongst the other curators here, Eloise and Gail. Their presence is incredible, and I love their work as well. So I'm just going to read three pieces, and I would say the best and most vaguest way to describe what I'm going to read today is pretty much the soundtrack that's currently happening in my head. And speaking of soundtrack, this first piece is a little bit inspired by a little bit of spaghetti Western music, a little bit of Oklahoma meets California, a little bit of Boys Don't Cry, because who doesn't love Hilary Swank in overalls and a girdle? So, for the marooned. Another Mojave town, a bare lot, an arid roadway scalding the froth of your hemline. Last night's history left a pithy residue, like burn marks, like tracks running along the forehead. Can't you see we're both strangers here? Beautiful fiends unearthed, left to dig through litter and lightning. Like a dove, I've watched you staring into the corn husk light. You want to rid yourself of those battered names, the loathe hanging on roofs of mouths. In the center of nothing, one more drink of roadside's nectar, snuff out suicide. Don't you know muddled nightmares are just nightmares, ghosts with a sweet tooth for fear? Darling Tempest, I pray you burst open that rotten back door with a silver pistol and galloping sound. Inamorata of flames, hitchhiker of dreams, anywhere in the echo blackness, rush, rush to some swirling field or rattlebone creek. I don't care. Let's you and me make it again and again ferocious. And my second piece, well, just it's an old piece, but it's been resurrected and has gotten a facelift, which I'm sure many of you out there that are writers know what that's like. Omen before heavy rain. I haven't felt the rumble of a monsoon in days. But if steam were to rise from this hot earth, then tumble, now is the time. Even rubber and pavement wait for the familiar outpour, rage in the spill and drench to wash our sins. I count each of my breaths under the shade of a vermilion nada. The tree has a burl the size of an elephant's knee bone, wrinkles for eyes, wraps its own tiny face in nodules and knots. Our cheeks brush one soft, another full of thistle. The sheen of fur and paw turns filthy, moist in the thickness of that summer. A spiral of flies dart above the crust of eyelids. What was a stout body now abandoned beneath my father's withered truck. A leash still grapples around his throat. I watch his belly cave in, his pupils swell bloodshot as if ready to explode, teeth bared. He soon transmutes into one of those port side mongrels, swallowing whole bones and fishtails, haunting the feet of some black Nazarene like a charred planet. My cousins scamper naked in sunray, their necks and chests caked in eucalyptus powder. I pray black magic would not steal his soul. I learn then death ruptures like a splinter of thunder. We all scatter like fire ants, our flimsy slippers airborne. And my final poem, yes, only three, is a new piece that was just birthed over the weekend at Idlewild, so I thought I would read it. It's an ode. To the sea, my serpent. To be swallowed like a slick and sticky red bean, the sweetest, most luscious bean is to look at you. To be inside you means to be instantly skinned just by your darkness, an eyelid that never really sleeps. How could I have allowed myself to ride you again and again, pretend like I know you, pretend like I came from your sultan womb, spat out like some flittering Bengal surgeon, starry triggerfish, ready to be your sycophant. My father used to steal slivers of milkfish as a child, lunge into you with only a crisp rice sack to cover his brown ass. I've got nothing on him. You live among ghosts. I have touched their skeletons, sprouting from your molars into serrated boulders and spines. I have fallen in love with somebody already dead. And you bring him to me now, bastard. And, oh, thank you. And just quickly before I close, I just wanted to read a really short three stanzas by another poet, Laureen Nidecker, her book, The Granite Pale. Goodbye to lilacs by the door and all I planted for the eye. If I could hear too much talk in the world, too much wind washing, washing good black dirt away. I've wasted my whole life in water. My man's got nothing but leaky boats. My daughter, writer, sits and floats. Thank you so much.
I've never had to raise the mic before. I know that it's a custom to thank the hosts, and I do thank the hosts. I also really want to thank all of you who support the Allowed program and the Allowed series, because it's really an intelligent audience, and it's a pleasure to read here and also to introduce new poets here, because this is kind of like the cream of the crop on both sides. So thank you all very much for coming tonight and welcoming new poets into our lives in Los Angeles. And then somebody said something about money. I don't understand that. Money, poetry, money. I know, but I do want to thank poets and writers and the Library Foundation for coming up with some remuneration for our poets. I was very happy to be able to send a couple of different emails saying, you're going to get more money. You're going to get more money. I've never done that before in my life. It's along the lines of a personal wish being fulfilled that I get to introduce two amazing poets to you, both of them native Angelinas. Many years ago, my friend and Chicana activist Cherie Moraga challenged me to seek out the Chicana bloodlines of the city, to look for the voices not only infrequently heard, but even more infrequently published. We both agreed that although mentoring is ultimately important, listening is even more crucial. And my heart has grown in the work of learning how Xochi, Julissa Bermejo, and Veronica Reyes have lived in this landscape and put it to the test of language. The first poet I would like to introduce is Xochi Julissa Bermejo. We met each other when Xochi was finishing her final term at the MFA program at Antioch, and I was going to be taking one student that term, and it was Xochi. And I always think it's kind of a blessing to be able to work with a person who's finishing the program and they're putting their manuscript together, and everything is kind of coming to a point there in which all of the personal sacrifices and all of the time spent and all of the concentration over a two-year period really kind of comes together, and you get down to the point to say, okay, now you're gonna make something that's like your first book. And it becomes, in a way, and I know this sounds maybe a little bit too big, but it becomes a sacred ritual that is a very important one to participate in with someone who's going to go out into the world and take her chances at this particular business. We put in a lot of work together because Xochi was also creating a piece of memoir. And she was beginning to wonder about what she would be doing with herself. At the time I met her, she was already teaching at Arroyo Pacific High School in the theater arts department and being involved in the production of theater pieces. And she was also beginning to venture out a little bit into the realm of poetry that I would say was more political. Having graduated, Xochi has really started upon the path that we kind of call the path to literary citizenship, in that she is very much involved with the poetry community and the literary community in Los Angeles. She is a literary curator at Beyond Baroque organization in Venice, which many of you I know are familiar with. And as part of her work there, she's created a series called Hitched, which is a reading series that puts together a writing mentor with a former student. And I think that that's a wonderful continuation to allow people who've worked together to come back together and see where each other is at a given moment. I've also been following work that she's been doing that I think has really been deepening and enriching her poetry, and that is her involvement with a training and volunteer opportunity called No More Death, which is sponsored to engage people in the work of immigration and immigration reform in the United States by putting people down at the border and engaging them in, at a minimum, leaving water for migrants who are coming across the desert. Many of them, as you know, die there for simple want of water. And Xochi went into that training, and I feel that the work that she's doing there is incredibly important for all of us to know about, but it's going to be incredibly important as her poetry about that kind of work develops. She's also the co-founder of a magazine called The Splinter Generation, and she has started to do some mentoring work with Write Girl, another organization that if you don't know anything about, you should become acquainted with. It gives young women in Los Angeles a chance to work free of charge with a highly trained writer and a gifted writer. And all of those things definitely refer to Xochi Julissa Bermejo.
I just have to say thank you, Eloise, for that beautiful intro, and working with her was an amazing time and also like very heart-wrenching too. I'd like go home and be like, oh my God, I'm never going to be brilliant. And it was just interesting because she gave me so much, and it took me like at least another year to kind of understand a lot of what she was telling me. And then with this Arizona project, I feel like even more so, things that she gave me 3 years ago now are really finding their way into my work. And so thank you for that. This first one is an Arizona poem. Meditation for the lost and found. There's a quote. You won't get lost if you take the road to the left and bear to the left at every crossroad. Jorge Luis Borges. Babakiri Peak is plastered on water gallons like children on milk cartons. If lost, keep Babo Peak to your left to find your way north. If lost, expect bones to be found by scorpions. Babo is an in case of forgetting, in case of getting left behind. But you have already run dry and dropped Babo on the ridge of Blank Man's Path. Border Patrol ambushed your group with semi-automatic rifles, and everyone has scattered. You are alone. You scramble to find north, to find the lights of a ranch house, to find another person. You are safe in your Phoenix home, with your children gathered at your feet. They remove your shoes and ask about the layers of dry, scaled blisters. You tell them their father nearly became a snake. You never see your children again. You never got to have a child. But as you lay your head in the sand and close your eyes, you hear her easy laugh echoing up through the Atascosas. You are found in the fetal position, a prayer card of San Judas crumpled in your fist. You are found by PP and sent to detention. The open gash on your knee goes unexamined. Your body goes unbathed. In a wood-paneled and beige federal courtroom, you sit next to others like you, pungent and petrified, ankles and wrists shackled one pair to the next. You move before the judge in unison, chains jingling like Christmas, and you feel like a reindeer, like a snow dog, like an animal. You never see a judge. You are dragged to the border south of San Diego and are beaten and tasered 5 times. You never again get to set foot on Mexican soil, but your screams for help are heard on both sides of the wall. You walk in the dark and carry a backpack stuffed with drugs. You carry this backpack because if you don't, the man with the gun pointed at your house will open fire. Because if you don't, the man with the gun pointed at your house will step inside and find your sister. Because if you don't, she has no chance. You have no choice. There are no drugs. You walk for work, for a safe place, for a kiss from your wife and to be lost in the scent of her hair. Your legs are cramping. You no longer know why Babo is important. You have lost the meaning of water. You are lost. You are desparecido, which means you will never be found. Thank you. So as Eloise was saying, last August I spent nine days out in the border in Aravaca, Arizona with this group No More Deaths, and we camp and we patrol trails and give water to people. And if you see someone in need, you give them medical attention. And so that's a lot of what that last poem was about, of stories I heard or people I met, came from a lot from that. And this next one, I wanted to honor Bird Baylor. She's a children's book author and poet, and she has a ranch in Aravaca, Arizona, and she allows for her property to be used all year long for this group. No More Deaths camps on her property. So I wanted to honor her as a poet and a writer and also as a humanitarian. So the first part of this poem comes from one of her poems. Nobody wanted a mountain to hate him. If one man killed another in a battle, he would quickly turn away from the man's sacred mountain before the mountain saw his face. Bird Baylor. If one man conquers another's land, he quickly turns away from new borders, scratched in sand, so as not to look into the eyes of those he means to forget. Nobody cares if he is hated Or maybe it's better to say, it is impossible to be hated by what no longer exists. What was once sacred no longer exists. I once climbed a sacred mountain and rested at a pass known only as Dead Man's. Dead Man should consider building a fence around his pass if it is truly his and he means to keep it. Nobody wants to be without one free pass, especially a dead man. Nobody battles and kills many things he never learned how to hold. The face of the mountain scowls at what has happened to its land. The sheer granite face of the mountain erodes, erasing all emotion because it is tired of hating. The sheer number of dead men is enough to make any mountain turn its back. And this next one of the reasons I wanted to go out there was because I wanted to write about the border and immigration from a personal experience. So this was my witness of being out there and being a volunteer and trying to build relationships with the long-term volunteers who are there all year long. So it's hard to build relationships with them because I'm only there for a short time and they have to deal with this all for months. So this is called To Chew the Empty Spaces, Aravaca, Arizona, August 25th, 2011. She craves conversation to chew the empty spaces where flash images, red gashed maple arms, vacant raisin eyes, mounds beneath branches, heartbeat to throat, rise like the dead. But Catherine remains relatively closed-lipped, like a grandmother at Lent, showing reverence for ghosts that refuse to be swallowed. We sleep in cots gathered in the open because it's better than being alone, she says, because it's better. I sleep in a one-person tent, so at the foot of my sleeping bag, listen for hisses and rattles, but hear revs and calls of four-wheel drug pickups in the gulch below. My thoughts circle with helicopters overhead, and I close eyes to visualize the color blue, the quench of water. Yesterday, I walked Catherine to Bird's Ranch, carrots in hand, to help her feed the horses. I watched yellow bees drink from troughs and listened to the buzzing. Here is where she shared the story of a girlfriend abandoned in Brooklyn along with the apartment, the one broken into while they were home, awake. She thinks I left her for another woman, she said. Catherine is like that apartment. She and I sit side by side on the roof of a silver Silverado and enjoy the sun's return over the teeth of a jagged night. This is my final morning. We share a cigarette and note the flash of a storm rumbling our way. I think, the desert is Ocotillo, calling the rain open-mouthed with too many tongues. But Catherine already knows this, and I say nothing, because it's better. And then this is my final poem. It's a separate thing. It's not from the desert. It's actually coming out in Calyx at the end of this month. And they barely were able to get this edition out because they didn't have money to pay the printer. So please stop by a bookstore and pick up Calyx and support them. They've been around since the 70s, and it's an awesome journal. So this is my final poem. My Hungry Socks, After Neruda. I fed my socks pieces of pink melon, but honestly, it did nothing to improve their stench. That didn't stop me from rubbing toes, peeking through holes against your calling leg. A crisp cold had engulfed the room, but you told me to stop, told me to get to my side. My socks and toes were still hungry for something sweeter than melon, something warmer than skin, stronger than vodka. The clink of cubes in a highball glass makes me thirsty, and I shiver. Good thing I have two wool socks. I bought them on a steep cobbled street in Bolivia from a woman in bowler hat and braids. Her cheeks were red and cracked like the terrain of a frozen, barren desert. I was just as frigid and unfulfilled, searching a country whose people were wild-eyed with want. If my toes had eyes, they'd only have eyes for you. Tomorrow, I will feed my socks honey yellow guava and hope it is enough. If only two wool socks in winter were enough. So I just want to say thank you again to Eloise for inviting me, and also to Suzanne and Gail, and Suzanne for helping us with Poets and Writers and everything. Thank you so much. And to the Aloud series, I love this space, and I love coming to all the lectures, and it was really cool to be able part of it. And the Library Foundation, and also Poets and Writers, and also to my friends and family, thank you for coming out.
She always says the best dresses. In 2006, I started an imprint with Red Hen Press called Arctoy Books, and once a year I publish one lesbian author because there just aren't enough of them getting published. Pure and simple, end of story. Up until this time, all of my authors have been from somewhere other than Los Angeles. And finally, I have an author from Los Angeles, and I am inordinately happy about that because I really love Los Angeles, and I know that Veronica Reyes loves Los Angeles too, particularly East Los Angeles, where she was born. And she sent me a manuscript, and as happens with a lot of manuscripts that I get, there will be one or two that come, and I just kind of put them on the side. I don't decide about them. And then at the end, I usually have about 5 to 10 of those. And often it's that first one that I've put to the side that I choose, and this was the case again. So I was very happy to meet her and to catch her when she's in town, because part of Veronica's career as a writer and an educator has taken her very far afield. She went to San Diego State University. She graduated from Long Beach State University. She earned an MFA from University of Texas at El Paso, Soy Tejana, El Paso. It frightens her when I say that. Because sometimes my Spanish is really like very, I don't know, French. She also taught in Toronto, Ontario, and she spent some time in Berlin and in Birmingham, England, and has now come back to Los Angeles, where she's an adjunct faculty member at Cal State LA. I want to list a few things that she has accomplished to date. She is a fellow with the Macondo Writers Workshop. She has received a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, Virginia Center for the Creative Arts Fellowship. She's been a participant at the Napa Valley Writers Conference and a resident at the Vermont Studio Center. As you can see, she's filling the world with her presence, not just with her words, but being places. And I think what I'm learning about her is that when she is in places, she's a creator of community. Somehow I always like writers who do that. To me, it seems somewhat a natural extension of a desire to express and communicate in language. I want to read you the entrance stanza to the manuscript that she sent me, because I was sold at the end of about these 16 lines. Thick clouds pulled over the cielo like a charcoal rebozo. Loud claps pounded as if manos slapped masa together, thundering the message, "I'm coming, I'm coming." And the withering grass, like a viejito, perked up to see, everyone looking up to the gray white puffs draping the sky.
Nopal and Hefte Mage stretched upward for fat drops. They waited so long for summer rains to inspire life again, and the sky opened its boca and awed a desert rain wind. Streams of plump gotas fell on top of the thirsty tierra, splattering the ground, leaving half lunas on the land. Veronica Reyes.
I gotta lower it. All right. Well, I'm Veronica Reyes from East LA, and thank you for coming out today. I appreciate it. I'm gonna read a few little pieces because I'm quite known for doing large pieces, but once in a while I do a little short one just to remind myself I could write a tiny piece too. This is Bad Flower. What a bad flower I am. Tis, tis, bad florecita. So many bad florecitas blooming out in cañoncitos, blossoming in glittery jardines, blooming out in dusty fronteras, blossoming in frosty Gran Lagos, blooming out in cobalt homes. You did not blossom nor bloom from un macho. You did not bloom nor blossom from un hombre. Tis, tis, bad, bad florecita. And I grin. Oh, yeah. My, my, what a bad flower I am. I didn't know that Eloise was going to read the first few lines of Desiree, and that's one of the poems I'm going to read. So hear how it's supposed to sound. I'll just play. Desert rain, blessing the land. Thick clouds pulled over the cielo like a charcoal rebozo. Loud claps pounded as if mano slapped masa together, thundering their message, I'm coming, I'm coming. At the withering grass like a viejito perked up to see a barullo. Everyone looked up to the gray white puffs draping the sky. Nopal and Hefte Mage stretched upward for fat drops. They waited so long for summer rains to inspire life again. And the sky opened its boca and awed a desert rain wind. Streams of plump gotas fell on top of the thirsty tierra, splattering the ground, leaving half lunas on the land. Socorro stepped outside her blue home near the freeway, let the warm water wet her brown arms by the awning's edge. She inhaled deeply, moist zacate, tierra, driveway. Zacatecas, el valle de mi corazón, Xochitl. Allá en el pueblito donde yo nací, olía como ocotillo y tunas. Xochitl clung to her ma's pale blue vestido, smiled, and stared at the big sky while standing on the red porch. Vowed a little sueño to herself and kept it tucked inside. She proclaimed proudly in her six-year-old voice, Zacatecas, mami, Zacatecas. Socorro laughed, and with her moist fingers, she anointed herself, then her daughter, with midday desert rain in the city. The agua took her back to her childhood in Mexico, rain that blessed her alma como copal, shrouding her skin. She inhaled the desert aroma over concrete nopales and limones beneath splintered street telephone wires. Socorro breathed in once and inhaled Mexico and East LA. Another little piece. Green helicopters. The apert orchard helicopter buzzed around, piercing the light blue sky, shaking loose brown particles, toxins, choking the air, the people, like in a migrant field. At noon, the air thickened, the sun sliced it. The unripe apple flew across the long rows, its spies like gunshots on the brown people, spiraling the streets of Sydney, Humphreys, tracking their cluttered grounds, their space. The crisp hollow copper pooled the blue-tinted cellophane, suffocating the poor people, draining the air of oxygen, life, spraying noise pollution like in an infested orchard field. And the canela-tinted borracha slurred, "I'll save your spot," to the oil-stained street. The cobalt car sled to the liquor store, and she stood waiting in the spot. A 45-year-old guarding an oil blotch, one hand on her blue waist, one hand on tilting a bottle. The sun's light sparkled a green glow, and the helicopter hovered for a bit. It swaggered like the drunken lady. The sun's light sparkled a green glow. Believing she was a parked car, believing her cerveza was life. And La Borracha stared at the green porch, sipped the beer, waiting for the cobalt car. A crooked grin splotched her lying mouth. Inside, she was silent. Inside, she was polluted. And she stared inside herself at night. The green helicopter sliced her thoughts. Years ago, she was a school teacher, taught elementary down at Brannock. The children loved her, called her Mrs. "Teacher, teacher, Brian is looking at me." She smiled with a squint, "Huh, mija?" And that was all she needed to do. The Apple Orchard helicopter cut the sky, piercing the souls, tinting their lives green every day, watching them with a scope. And final little piece, something to get you excited. Not that you weren't already, but there it is. Marimacha. She strutted down Whittier Boulevard, checking out the rucas on the calle. A bien suave Chicana butch dyke, hair slicked back with Les Flores, glistening against her earth-toned skin. Cut-off khakis right at the knees, smooth creased on the pant legs, starched white camisa over her undershirt. Fruit of the Looms, a true homeboy's brand, bought at JCPenney. Learned how to planchar as a little chamaca, ironing papi's shirts, pantalones, cada madrugada, ironing her hermanito's school clothes cada día. No time for studying, no time to be a kid. Learned how to planchar, just like her ma. And when Carmen ran across Federally Avenue amidst the drowning yellow to the stoplight, she placed her palm on her leathered, black lettered belt and jogged as if the pinchy cops were chasing her. Homebred in East LA. Carmen walked like she owned the guys. This body was hers, Arizona Maravilla. Carmen strutted down Whittier Boulevard as she headed towards the Golden Gate Theater. She savored Garfield High School memories, where she used to neck and make out with Josefina. In the back rows hidden by the darkness, a white beam streamed over them like a rio, splashing a Pedro Infante movie on the screen. Josefina, her main bruca, era mujer, oh mujer, firme, nice smooth curves, strong hips to cradle Carmen's body, tattered soul, back into her whole self, pressing lips, bodies together, savoring chocolate nipples, excited her. Yeah, ese, if I had a penis or real one, not one of those pinchy plastic shits, I'd move it in, out, beg, make her beg, ese, I know how to please a mujer, keep my mija satisfied. And she rubbed her panza, remembering high school days where she used to make out with Josefina, where no vato or ruca would mess with her, because they knew she kicked ass like any decent vato. On the streets, Carmen earned the reputation of a peleonera. When she was new, little, everybody knew que era marimacha. Porque when Carmen fought, peleó como una pinche loca, con fists, crowbars, patadas y más, and the vata always won the pleitos. Nunca lloró, nunca gritó, solamente grunted y cussed out every vato. Fuck you, puto. Chupame ese. On the guys, Carmen earned the respect of a true vato, a homegirl always down for her barrio, and Carmen was damn proud of her reputation as she strutted down Whittier Boulevard in East LA, remembering La Vida Loca, Marimacha style. Y que... Thank you.
I have a dyslexia about how tall I am. I think I'm way taller than I am, but okay, that's probably right. Anyway, I'm Gail Ronsky. I'm so happy to be here and to be part of this event, and I want to thank Louise Steinman and Suzanne Loomis for doing this for so many years, because it's a very subversive act, as you can see, bringing new voices into a dignified setting like this. I mean, the wood is different now than it was when we first got here. Anyway, I am introducing Mia Carley, who was a student of mine at Loyola Marymount University, and one of those absolutely brilliant students that you can't take credit for. I mean, I'm just the person who was lucky enough to have Mia in a few workshops while I was there. And now she has just finished her first year in the Iowa Writers' Workshop, which is incredible, a real accomplishment. But I kind of feel like, if you remember the Simpsons episode where they go to Australia, you know, and Bart takes a frog or something, and it ends up changing the entire ecosystem of Australia. I kind of feel that way about sending Mia to Iowa. Anyway, Mia's work is incredibly rhythmic, incredibly rolling and rollicking, and also smart and inventive. And I think of her passion for writing, when I think about it, a phrase from Wallace Stevens comes to me, which is, "The maker's rage to order words." I think that's what Mia has, and please welcome her.
All right, so I have like 98 poems that I'm gonna read now. This is the first one. That was a bad joke. Jesus, God, we had a sound check. Is this loud? No, it's good. You know, I've taken classes with 50% of the readers here, and good God, it's good to see where everybody's gone. You know, I would like to thank my family for being here, and my friends. And I would really like to thank Chuck and Gail, because there's no way I would be writing, because I thought writing was really stupid without them. I'm going to read one thing. I just want everybody to maybe feel like you're pregnant for 5 seconds. By 5 seconds, I mean, like, you know, 9 minutes. It's called Masticate, Masticate, Masticate. Is this too loud? I'm kidding. In that opera house mouth of a mouth, the midwife hums through the smell of stuffy delivery as she prods her hands between the mother's legs, as rye bread sculpts her teeth, as she pokes pastrami back into the corners of the bread. The mother gasps for air. Good, she says. Good. Keep going. Good. And behind the thinly sliced words, the mother's pungent gas swallow the sound of the humming and the chewing. The chapel men outside scrutinize the logic behind the screaming. They watch smoke rise from steeples and talk parallels. Between the mother's legs, she clenches teeth, tongue, lips, and squeezes, "Keep going!" Through a slip of breath, "Push!" gets stuck in her throat as she swallows hard against the meat, beating, beating, beating down in the blood. With a wet towel and a syringe, "Push!" Wipe rye bread from her teeth with her right hand, then sweat from her forehead with her left. Push! Wiping both hands on the wet towel and returning to her sandwich as the mother gnaws at the bed with rasping hands, pushing and screaming, her screams slip through the smoke, through the steeple, through the air, and the ears of the chapel men, squinting children eyes. The men poke fingers at the sky and make parallels. The children bleach the smoke with their blemishes and watch screams drip down from unfinished church walls where paint cans catch them to swallow the red, to suffocate the pulse, to swallow the red and suffocate the pulse, to make the silence of the white swirl unconditionally. Metal road signs bend reedy in the wind to surround the onlookers and to push a white blushing gloom against the walls of eyes, against the men and their children, with their lungs breathing heavy, their tongues clumpy in their hymns, men strangled by the sugar-soot sky, men melting like lead into its lean gray skin, men beating their hands together and giving birth to parallels, men with their children comforted by ashy snow, stomping like thoroughbreds to the bridges of their lips, while they suck it like sticky candy from their teeth. The slender sound of chewing makes its way through the empty halls of church. Push, push, push surges from the orange pores of the building, separating heat from light as if attempting to combust, as if attempting to perpetuate a lopping, clamming hope that could burn the building down, as if to burn the building down, as if to smolder the sound of people gleaming. It makes beads like particles of dust from every pore of every man's sludging skin. It wraps them in blankets of dung sweat. Light warps the children's faces, dragging flimsy shrapnel through their big blonde eyes to swallow the white, to form thick black walls, to swallow the white and build big black walls, to swallow the white and flash crude images of red back and forth. Young retinas swing teeter-tottering between white, screams wrap metal wires around the church. Push! Masquerades around the church in a purple fur coat, floundering promiscuously through the pews, pounding its hands at the wood, humming behind the sound of chapel men singing, prodding its pink Renaissance mask between the mother's legs. It surges from the midwife's clenched mouth, buckling her teeth, purging her eyelids, soaking her mouth with the taste of rye bread and poultry, before skittering to a halt on the floor. Beside the bed, the slender lamp leans over the mother's neck, tramples the tight skin of her face, shoots arrows of callous light through her damp eyes. Irises squeeze blood up against the lashes. She lashes out, shivering behind her musket, waiting to be brushed through the smoke, waiting to be bound by the midwife's humming, the humming behind the chewing, the humming and the chewing behind the push, arms purging against the columns of carnage, leaning its quiet red body against the suede silked-up curtains that purge back, back and through the thighs, back and through the heart, in to sip the yellow bits of strength from the fledging pipes of the smallest part of the back, the yellowmost parts of the arteries. It winds itself all the way down to the marrow, pulls out its big, strong hands, scratches its big, glamorous nails out up against the spine, finds the levers of little on and off switches, switches them on and off, off, on, off, on, off, on, stuttering only to turn its volume up and up and up and up. It turns the knob, circles around the push. It circles around the push, turns the knob all the way up to the screaming mother, and her dripping strains become vessels stuck behind their leather-stretched throats. Her throat is now wild tape being stretched from its roll, reaping water from the tunnel, reaches its black body through the frumpy blood of the mother, through the frumpy skin of the pipes, built silver inside the church, running narrow corners into narrow corners, metal fixtures bending at their joints, the ache of constant breathing trapped inside residual flow of blood, cells, the pipes stammer behind the movement of emptiness, pushing through to the outside where the men breathe, every filtered muscle of dirty pushing in through their noses. Dead grains stick in their teeth. She prods her tongue into her porous gums, sticking dry wheat through her broiled gums, latching onto the pinkest parts of her plump gums, with her tongue, catching sweat with her upper lip and licking wet with wet every time she squeezes a sound through her purple mouth, her lungs melting under the heat of the mother's legs wrapped around her shoulders, wrapping around her shoulders, warping her shoulders into a vamp pile of dirt, wearing her shoulders like a beet skirt, tearing at the edges tearing at the seams tearing up into petals like brash sweat, into beads of blood waning down to the white bed and on top of the damp black-brown floor. The mother is red, pushing her hands down and pushing her face back. Silver whining creeps through the pipes and lines the smoke outside with thin horsehair. The tiny hair blisters against the sky, weaving high pitches, squirms evaporating. The men, like stinted statues, peer up, mouths open, big black holes breaching sound, working around sound through the buttons of their tongues, swallowing the humming now and gawking again, bending the sides of their mouths, dumbfounded by the screaming. Their children get quieter. Tarps collect mud on the floor. Her white shoes turn red. Thick piles of red spill onto the mother. Thick limbs spill out of the mother. Screams spill out of the mother. The mother is quiet, staring up at the stagnant ceiling. Frothy, pasted stucco cowers behind the swamping blood. Trails of concrete drip from the low ceiling, getting lower. Closing in on the mother, eyes twittering in against the spin of the room, pushing her deep into the bed, she swallows dry, hard air as the midwife wipes down her legs with hot towels. The midwife's hum is now a fever in her mouth. The heat explodes into wet sweat from the sides of her face. She walks back and forth from the corner of the room, moving towels back and forth. Blood traps blood on the floor. Growing swamp of mud red grows, littered into towels on the floor in the corner. The humming gets louder in the corner. The center gets louder in the center. The church gets louder, like some big purple drone has escaped from a tiny lead hole, split the corners with some big black bomb, pushed its big black arms through the air to meet the chapelmen screaming hymns at the sky, to meet the children giving their eyes to the wind carrying blood soot around the site. The midwife cuts through the neck. The bed is quiet behind the humming and the chewing. The chewing gets louder as the midwife sits humming in blood, savoring the smell of wet poultry, swallowing rye bread, and savoring the wet sandwich. She stares at the diced mess. Smoke blooms, and the ceiling is stagnant. Thanks.
Okay, Paul, you're up. Looking at me? Paul's from New York. Paul Lieber has been around for a while, and many of you who know anything about the poetry community in L.A. know Paul Lieber because he's the executive producer and host of Why Poetry on KPFK, which is an amazing and wonderful program, and yeah. When I was a guest on the program, we got to the end of the interview and Paul said to me, "So, is there anything you don't have ambivalent feelings about?" I said, "Well, yes and no." Paul's poems are, well, first of all, I want to say that he's here because his first book of poems has just come out with Thibaut Bach Press. It's called Chemical Tendencies, and it's fantastic. Yeah. His work is masculine and rough-edged, and it seems to, it sometimes really push us out of our comfort zones, which is a great thing. It's what poetry should do. But there's also always a highly nuanced questioning and a subtle examining of the world's strangeness, which I always find really interesting. So please welcome Paul Lieber.
Thank you, Gail, for that. I won't say too much because
I want to remain subtle. But I do want to have a kid, and I got to raise this mic. I'm so fucking stupid. I should have listened. I should have watched. Ah, there we go. Thank you, thank you. I want to thank the Aloud series. I want to thank Suzanne, Eloise, and Gail, and all of you. It's a great space. I'm a great guy. The first one is called San Juan Capistrano Mission. And if anybody has a kid here in the public school, you know about the Mission Project. The Mission from Hell Project. It's not age appropriate, and you end up doing this. But anyway, you picked the mission you want to go to, and we went to San Juan Capistrano Mission. The chipped facade of cream brick, the uneven plaster reminds me of my apartment on 17th, those little hills for floors, the toilet in the hall, and dreams of the tenement swaying. Forget stiff interpretations of the Bible and the slaughter of infidels. Stay with the mortar, stones, and age. The adobe couches, those motherly laps in the garden away from the burn of the sun, and the mission of this mission. I hear my father through the archways. Religion killed half the human race. I stroll into the gilded chapel as narrow as that flat downtown, but the ceiling with its primitive beams and mismatched lines climbs to the heavens, and Latin chants swirl so, I pull up a tear and pray as involuntarily as any seduction. The winding chant pulls me further to those holy stories, to the creepy almighty calling, and I, obedient music, am summoned past the rape of Aunt Jenny, past the repairman fiddling with a hinge, above the bombings to the east, I'm over the ruins, above the gift shop, above the bells, a single note, an infidel, rising. This one is called Cock. I did a film where my son was marrying a transgender, though I don't think I have to explain to anybody here what a transgender is, but it's a woman in a man's body, and this is from the point of view of perhaps the father, the character, or perhaps the actor. You have to make that decision. Cock. She talks like a girl, not girly talk, it's a generous, considerate sound, and sports her frilled dress and heels like incidentals, carries herself as if those genitals don't indicate a thing. She's my son's girlfriend, and they're tender. I think about touching those breast implants, running my tongue up her legs, but her dick swings like a chandelier. Though it's taped to the inner thighs somewhere, it's that dick I can't stop thinking of. The scrotum and testicles like a Clydesdale's, like a Great Dane's, hanging there oddly with nothing to do. Ignored like those distant mountains that irrigate the lower plains. I give her a Thai fan, and she says, thank you. Opens it, waves the air, as if she's entitled to the breeze she creates. Thank you. This is a typical day in Los Angeles. A car swerves in front of the Mercedes in front of me, and the Mercedes stops, and I stop, but the car behind slams my rear, and I hit the Mercedes in the rear, and we all pull to the side of the 101 3/4 of a mile to the 110 going south at 6:45 p.m. to exchange our dates of birth and other intimacies. The guy in the Mercedes tells me he's attracted to men and women. I tell him 30 years ago my wife was crushed in a head-on and I could only identify her legs. The woman behind us speaks Mandarin but cries in that universal sob.
and the registration whispers that the Ford is not hers. I uncork a bottle of Milagro, and we drink to our entanglement. To the 101 freeway, somber sips for the 40,000 a year killed in collisions. We pay homage to the deer mowed down on the 405, to the possums that blended with the 90, to the mangled, licensed and unlicensed dogs, to mutts and pedigrees, cats, squirrels, coyotes, and the seagull that couldn't take flight fast enough. The 40 proof no longer burns, while the freeway goes stance in the Santa Ana winds, then relax on our dented hoods and fenders. We hide the tequila in our mood when the highway patrol arrives in wool-blended shirts, though the temperature is 98. We answer questions, thank them for clearing the battlefield, hug one another, deflate our airbags, and roll. Looking for a handkerchief. I should have brought a handkerchief. Thought of everything but a handkerchief. The Patrick's Roadhouse, which maybe you've passed, you know, and it's a place that, you know, people never mentioned to me, you know, that you just passed it, and then finally I went into the goddamn place, and it absolutely blew my mind, you know? People, yeah. Anyway, here's Patrick's Roadhouse. It's a mingling of the dead with scrambled eggs and hash browns. A way to arrange the clutter of a mind, the civil wars at rest. We're at the edge of a continent, back in heaven. The counter I sip at has been leaned on for decades, and the wooden booths alongside windows alongside the Pacific could make me weep for booths, counters, for when the train stopped here, for when there was a train. Oh, please spare us eulogies to diners, luncheonettes, to collectibles. Here's a framed copy of an old sailboat with a white crust of a wave and no wind to move it. No, no winds in here. Tulips next to a chest step, next to sugar, photos of what was and never was. There's the Palisades in mud 1,000 years ago, a Royal Air Force sign, and one for Bigger Hill. Renaissance-style copies of sketches with Renaissance garg among pseudo-antiques. These gargoyles, oils, and a wall lit with easily forgotten sayings create a forest from pawn shops where I wouldn't buy a thing. But I lose myself in this labyrinth the way I can lose myself in a broken woman. I climb four brick stairs to the stained glass chandeliers where checkered floors bounce off a poster. Cat on the Hot Tin Roof by the late Tennessee Williams starring a dead Paul Newman at odds with the dead Elizabeth Taylor. Listen to the surf creep to the counter. A street lamp is a stud with a French flag wrapped around it like a scarf, like my dead Uncle Jack, adorned with an ascot, ready to light up the room. I had time, I'm really bad on time. I don't mean what time is it, but how much time do I have left? Another poem? Okay, great. Now I gotta pick the poem. Well, why don't I go with this? You know, I just wrote this, I don't know if you've written a poem. You know, I hate so ingrown to write a poem about writing a poem. But if you've written a poem and then you go to a place that you've wrote the poem about, it's for me, it's like the poem competes with the place. Like, it's hard to get into the place without getting into the poem, you know, that whole thing. And so it keeps you out of the present in a way. Anyway, this is called Lost Cause. When you've written a poem about the pier, and you're on the pier, as I am, it's as if I walk the halls of the poem. Where are the girls with boom boxes whom I predict a doom for? Stone, homeless, shackled in marriage? Where are the sardines that wiggled for life on the ledges? Today, mackerel beg for mercy, twist and shimmer at the end of their line. Legless, one leaps into a painting. I suppose the croakers and bass swim elsewhere. The fishermen repeat in their mostly Latino numbers. A pelican floats into a stanza, oblivious to free verse. The tents have vanished. My son had grasped my hand in a rhyme, asked many soft questions. Today I'm alone, while tourists trample over this plank. Where is the bounce in the grain? This family speaks Swedish. They sprinkle their words over the pier, over some lost quatrains, or quatrains, whichever you prefer. That's not in the poem, but anyway, thank you very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.